Hi folks, hope you're well. This is Jim Carroll, welcoming you to a special series of Banter Podcasts recorded at the Web Summit in Lisbon earlier this month. Bill James is probably best known as the influential American baseball writer, historian and founder of Sabermetrics, but there's another side to Bill too, and that's his interest in our cultural obsession with murder and popular crime. Aside from talking about his books Popular Crime and the forthcoming Man from the Train, about an early 20th century serial killer, he also talks stats and polling, and dodged a question about Tipperary hurling too. Please excuse the background noise on the podcast. The banter stage of Web Summit was located in the main hall, and there was a lot of coming and going during the day.
Banter series here at Web Summit. For those of you who don't know, Banter is a travelling roadshow of informal, laid-back conversations with various people that we admire. And this man here, Bill James, we really admire you. Bill, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you, sir.
And thank you very much for coming along.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I heard you earlier on talking about baseball, so I'm going to park the baseball. I'm going to talk to you about murder instead.
All right.
And crime. Where does your interest in that come from?
The same place that my interest in baseball came from. It came from newspapers of the moment that I became aware of the world. I was living in a small town, middle of nowhere, didn't have a TV. Newspapers connected us to the world. They're full of crime and baseball.
Okay, so let's take how newspapers would have covered crime back in the day. You know, they cover crime in a very specific way. There was very much, it was heroes and villains. There were broad brushstrokes. It was a very macro reading of crime.
That's probably true. Sure.
And like, I mean, what about the writing attracted you in?
It's not the writing. It's the. What is fascinating about crime stories is that they dwell on those parts of our personalities that we otherwise try to hide. All of the things that we don't talk about, but which are parts of our personality, like lust and anger and greed and fear and the will to dominate others. All of those things, which are parts of our soul, we hide them all the time, and they come out in crime stories. They come out more in crime stories than anywhere else. So that's what's fascinating about them.
Do you think, you know, it's possible for every single person in the audience here to be a murderer?
It seems statistically improbable.
Okay, so I've been facetious, but like, do you think the possibility of committing crime, and violent crime, exists in us somewhere?
My basic answer is no, but most people are never ever going to be. But if you're stressed enough, I mean, you must have been in a traffic jam caused by some annoying person, and if you had a gun, you would have shot them. If you magnify those kind of stresses to a sufficient level, then we all do reach a point at which we're capable of doing something terrible.
Right. And like, I mean, when you decided to publish that book, when you decided to publish the popular crime book,
yeah.
You know, did you feel there was an audience out there who would appreciate that and who would look at it beyond what is normal, or was this something you felt, okay, I want to do this?
No, it's the latter. I want to do this, and if somebody wants to read it, that's great, and if nobody wants to read it, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And my whole career has been that way. I've never tried to figure out what other people wanted me to do and then do it. I do what I'm interested in doing.
In terms of like popular crime, the book, you know, did you kind of, were there kind of, I suppose, crime stories that you wanted to include? Were there things you had to leave out?
Well, I left out stories that there's a great abundance of crime in the history of the world. I mean, there's a fantastic abundance of crime. And so you have to leave out 99.99% of it. So the question really isn't what you leave out, it's what you include. What you include is that stuff which has unanswered questions. That which has, if there's a crime about which people believe the person to be innocent although he's guilty, or believe someone to be guilty although he's innocent, I would write about that. Or if there's a crime about which we just simply don't know, and there's a chance of figuring out why we don't know and how we screwed this up and why we don't know what we should know, then you write about that one.
Right. like, obviously as well, you know, what you're talking about there chimes with a huge audience, because we've seen the success in recent years of Making a Murderer, we've seen the success of Serial, you know, we have this kind of fascination with, like, it's not always as clear-cut as it is, you know?
That's right. These are serious events. I mean, people don't want to talk about them, but they dominate our culture. You turn on your TV at any moment, and there are crime stories on 4 or 5 channels, and there are made-up crime stories on more channels. It's a powerful attraction, and it's a powerful attraction for good reasons. These are serious events that help to shape our culture, and we don't want to talk about them. We don't want to talk about it because they're not nice. You know, nice people don't commit murder, and nice people don't talk about it. But it's a serious subject.
And, like, it's going back to what you were talking about earlier on, you know, you were talking about, like, how the stresses can push someone to do something they don't plan, you know, and that thing you've just said there about nice people committing these crimes, you know. I'm curious about the psychology as well. When you look at the psychology of those who commit the crimes, is there always a kind of a switch that goes off? And is there ever a chance of repeat offenders?
Sure. There are some people. I mean, most murders are committed by people who are criminals. most murders are committed by people who also steal and beat their wives and do criminal type junk. Not that many are committed by people who are ordinarily living solid lives.
It's always those ones as well. I mean, I know from kind of, say, in Ireland and the UK, the crimes that get the most attention in the press are always the ones where the suspect is a nice guy,
right?
Somebody you don't suspect.
It's the dog, man bites dog story. The exception gets the attention, and people sometimes confuse what gets the attention for what is normal.
But both Serial and Making a Murderer kind of, like, focused in on one particular crime in particular, you know. Is there a crime in your mind that you kind of go, this is something I'd like to do more on? This is something that kind of demands a deeper dive.
Well, I have another crime book. Since I'm here, I'll...
This is Man on the Train.
The man from the Train, yeah. And that is that. It's a crime that happened 100 years ago that I got interested in. And followed until we actually made progress on it.
Okay, well, can you give me the basic outline of that particular crime?
There is a horrible and famous murder which happened in Villisca, Iowa, 104 years ago. Right? 8 people were murdered in a locked house with an axe in the middle of the night on a quiet, peaceful street in a small town in the middle of nowhere. It was known at the time, or it was widely suspected at the time, that the person who had done this must have done this before, that there were a few other crimes that were linked at the time to the same criminal. But my realization was that with modern technology, you could connect the dots in a way that was beyond imagination 100 years ago. 100 years ago, what happened in one small town stayed there, and people weren't aware. So we started looking for other crimes that might have been committed by the same person, and we found one, and then we found another, and we found another. And eventually, working it back, we figured out who it was. And I know that's incredible, and you're not going to believe it, but we did. I should say we, but it was actually my daughter who was working with me. She actually found him. There's a 15-year odyssey that this disturbed person. He was about 5'5" or 5'6". He was very muscular. He was never clean. He was German by birth. He went around America killing families of people. He would ride into town in the afternoon, break into someone's house in the middle of the night, kill the family, get back on the train, and disappear. They never caught him. He is certainly one of the worst serial murderers ever. We got interested in him, and then we got lucky,
And then I got more interested.
Okay, so let's leave it there then, so people in the audience can buy the book when it comes out in 2017. Okay, so let's turn then from kind of like murders and crimes back to what you're, I suppose, known for best and why you're here as well, which is like, I mean, the baseball statistics and sabermetrics.
Right.
You know, I'm curious. I've read a lot of interviews with you in the lead up to this interview, and I'm curious about one thing. It's like, are you struck in any way, shape, or form by how this thing you started out back in when you were working as a night watchman, this kind of like this data metrics, this kind of like data, this data mining, that has suddenly become such a huge industry?
I'm constantly astonished, and it gets bigger every year. And I mean, I was astonished at the size it had grown to by 1993, and I'd say it's doubled every year since 1993. Maybe not. My son, who's a software engineer, has this rule that they use about the processing capacity. It's called. It's sort of the same thing. It just keeps on mushrooming, and I'm constantly astonished by it.
Yeah. What strikes me as really unusual is that it's now become part and parcel of nearly every sport going. I'm from Ireland, so I'm a big fan of Gaelic games like hurling and Gaelic football.
Uh-huh.
And the winning All-Ireland hurling team this year, Tipperary, had implied people to look at the data. And this is an amateur game. Like, it seems to strike me that it's gone so wide. What's been the most unusual reference to sabermetrics and that data mining that you've come across in sports?
Oh, wow. I couldn't give you one. I'm sorry.
And also, do you kind of find as well sometimes that the way it's used appalls you?
Well, the public really doesn't have any understanding of what we do exactly. And I'll try to explain it. What we do is to try to connect the ground level information with the questions that hang down from the sky. And the questions that are hanging down from the sky are, why does one team win and the other lose? What is good for the game? What are the most important measures? The ground level statistics are like brass. There's a million of them. And analysis, what we do is figure out how those things that cover the ground are related to those questions that hang down from the sky. And I don't think people think that crap that appears on television about what this guy has hit on in the seventh inning or later is what we do. But in reality, what we do is to fight that stuff off. I mean, that's crabgrass. There's nothing you can do with it. What we do is try to find in the ground level stuff what is actually interesting and useful and somehow connects to the big question.
And like what you say as well about like fact that you kind of say sometimes that people don't really know this, people don't really appreciate this. And like, do you find as well sometimes that like, there are professionals as well in this sector who don't really know exactly what they're grappling with either?
Oh yes, all the time. Sure, there are lots of people who claim to be in the field who really don't have any conceptual framework of what we're doing. Sure.
I want to take it back to kind of like the events of last night, 3,000 miles across the Atlantic, you know?
Right.
And in an awful lot of kind of like the post-election coverage this morning, there's this kind of thing about the death of polling and the way the polling got things wrong. As someone who, like me, works all the time with like me, data, and like is able to kind of like join the dots and join that kind of like sky and ground thinking together, what's your take on how polling works in the States for this election cycle?
Well, what happened last night is not the death of polling. It's a rebirth of polling. It does mean that something is fundamentally wrong there. And if you watch political coverage, they're so proud of doing polling right. This isn't a good poll. This is not a good poll. This is a good poll. This one's done right. Well, the people who are doing it right are doing it wrong. And that probably means that some of the people who are doing it wrong are actually doing it right. I would bet that you could find... Well, I'm quite certain that people will emerge in the next week or so who somehow had this figured out better than the mainstream guys, and it will be a kind of rebirth of polling. It'll mean the old thing where you take a voter list and call people up if they have landlines, which nobody does anymore. That's dead. That's gone. That didn't work. It really hasn't worked for quite a while.
If you were to kind of give some advice to polling companies who'd be like scratching their heads this morning and wondering like, is the sky falling down? What would your advice to them be?
Stop using a narrow model. Start using a broad model. Don't use one method to reach the ball. And the they want to use one method to use the, to reach the audience. And the reason they do that is that they know what the parameters of that one method are, so they know how to make statistical adjustments to it and that sort of thing. But don't use one method. Use as many different methods as you can. Set up a stand where you give people a free candy bar if they'll sit and fill out your form, right? And also call people on the phone and do email surveys and walk down the street with a microphone and find clever and imaginative things to do, like walk around with a picture of Donald Trump and see how many people follow you. And find different ways, and then the successful polling of the future will be that which is able to put all of these different clever methods together rather than one which takes a narrow method and then refines it and refines it and refines it to where it actually relates to a battle that goes on all the time in my field. Whenever we find a way to measure something new, and I'm supposing that most of you are not baseball fans, but in baseball, a runner occasionally goes from first to third on a single, and sometimes he doesn't go from first to third on a single. Well, the way you measure how good a runner is from going first to third on a single is you count how many times he's on first and how many times a single hit and how many times he goes to third. But when you tell people that, they want, well, we don't want to count these because these are infield hits, and we don't want to count those because there was a runner on base ahead of him, and we don't want to count those because the ball was hit over the right fielder's head, but it happened to be a single. And you wind up with seven examples in a season when you should have 50. It's the same thing. Don't use a narrow focus that gives you an excuse to eliminate data. Instead, use a broad focus and figure out how to make use of all the data.
It strikes me as you're talking there, Bill, about broadening the base and doing things differently. In many ways, that's where you came in originally. That's where things started for you, by doing what no one else was doing. And it strikes me that the lesson to be learned is often that when polling companies and when data people scale, they all stick to the same narrow, rigid path. They're afraid to go deep, afraid to go wide.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Last couple of questions, and I really, really appreciate you giving us the time as well, and coming over to join us here at the Banter stage. Last couple of questions. You work as a consultant or with the Red Sox. Right?
I do, that's right.
So, what's John? I'm a Liverpool FC fan, so I'm curious about John Henry's take on data. Is that something that's very paramount to him?
Yes.
What's his takeaway from it?
John's fortune is built on intelligent data analysis, and he's the most data savvy person in any discussion you're in. He's sort of frightening to talk to sometimes because he's a very nice person. He's if you give him any chart of numbers, he wants to know what's the number that's behind this and what's the number behind. Well, you give him a chart of 80 numbers, and he'll pick the one that you haven't properly backed up and start asking you about it. But he's as much into data as anybody.
Bill James, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure to meet you. Thank you very much. Bill James, everybody.
Many thanks to Bill for joining us at Banter, and thanks to Dara, Eleanor, Katrin, James, Kira and Richard at Web Summit, and local crew Josh, Caesar and Ricardo for all their help with Banter in Lisbon. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Be sure to check out the other podcasts from Banter at Web Summit and thisisbanter.com for news of what we're up to. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again real soon.